of their precious foodstuffs, including more than 2 tons of butter, before they could sail from Southampton. Adding to the turmoil and confusion was the behavior of Christopher Martin. The Mayflower's governor was, according to Cushman, a monster. "He insulteth over our poor people with such scorn and contempt," Cushman wrote, "as if they were not good enough to wipe his shoes. If I speak to him, he flies in my face as mutinous, and saith, no complaints shall be heard or received but by himself." In a letter hastily written to a friend in London, Cushman saw only doom and disaster ahead. "Friend, if ever we make a plantation, God works a miracle, especially considering how scant we shall be of victuals, and most of all, ununited amongst ourselves and devoid of good tutors and regiment. Violence will break all. Where is the meek and humble spirit of Moses?" When it finally came time to leave Southampton, Cushman made sure he was with his friends aboard the Speedwell. He was now free of Martin, but soon found that the Speedwell was anything but speedy. "She is as open and leaky as a sieve," he wrote. As they watched the water spout through the gaps in the planking, he and his compatriots from Leiden were reminded of the earthen dikes in Holland, claiming that the water came in as at a mole hole. Several days after clearing the Isle of Wight off England's southern coast, it was decided they must put in for repairs, and both vessels sailed for Dartmouth, a port only 75 miles to the west of Southampton. It was now August 17th. The repairs were quickly completed, but this time the wind refused to cooperate. They were stuck in Dartmouth, a rock-rimmed harbor surrounded by high, sheltering hills, waiting for a fair breeze. People were beginning to panic, and with good reason. "Our victuals will be half eaten up, I think, before we go from the coast of England," Cushman wrote. Many of the passengers decided it was time to abandon the voyage. Even though they'd lose everything they had so far invested, which for some of them amounted to everything they possessed, they wanted out. But Martin refused to let them off the Mayflower. "He will not hear them, nor suffer them to go ashore," Cushman wrote from Dartmouth, "lest they should run away." The months of unremitting tension had caught up with Cushman. For the last 2 weeks he had felt a searing pain in his chest, a bundle of lead, as it were, crushing my heart. He was sure this would be his last goodbye. "Although I do the actions of a living man, yet I am but as dead. I pray you prepare for evil tidings of us every day. I see not in reason how we shall escape even the passing of hunger-starved persons, but God can do much, and his will be done." They departed from Dartmouth, and were more than 200 miles beyond the southwestern tip of England, at Land's End, when the Speedwell sprang another leak. It was now early September, and they had no choice but to give up on the Speedwell. It was a devastating turn of events. Not only had the vessel cost them a considerable amount of money, but she had been considered vital to the future success of the settlement. They put in at Plymouth, about 50 miles to the west of Dartmouth. If they were to continue, they must crowd as many passengers as would fit into the Mayflower and sail on alone. To no one's surprise, Cushman elected to give up his place to someone else, and despite his fear of imminent death, he lived another 5 years. It was later learned that the Speedwell's master, Mr. Reynolds, had been secretly working against them. In Holland, the vessel had been fitted with new and larger masts, a fatal mistake that was probably done with Reynolds's approval, if not at his suggestion. As any mariner knew, a mast crowded with sail not only moved a ship through the water, it acted as a lever that applied torque to the hull. When a ship's masts were too tall, the excess strain opened up the seams between the planks, causing the hull to leak. By overmasting the Speedwell, Reynolds had provided himself with an easy way to deceive this fanatical group of landlubbers. He might shrug his shoulders and scratch his head when the vessel began to take on water, but all he had to do was reduce sail, and the Speedwell would cease to leak. Soon after the Mayflower set out across the Atlantic, the Speedwell was sold, refitted, and according to Bradford, made many voyages to the great profit of her owners. Bradford later assumed that Reynolds's cunning and deceit had been motivated by a fear of starving to death in America. But the Pilgrims appear to have been the unknowing victims of a far more complex and sinister plot. Several decades later, Bradford's stepson, Nathaniel Morton, received information from Manhattan that indicated that the Dutch had worked to prevent the Pilgrims from settling in the Hudson River region by creating delays while they were in England. Morton claimed it was the Mayflower's master, Christopher Jones, who was responsible for the deception. But there is no evidence that Jones was anything but a loyal and steadfast friend to the Pilgrims. It was Reynolds, not Jones, who had kept them from sailing. In early September, westerly gales begin to howl across the North Atlantic. The provisions, already low when they first set out from Southampton, had been eroded even further by more than a month of delays. The passengers, cooped up aboard ship for all this time, were in no shape for an extended passage. Jones was within his rights to declare that it was too late to depart on a voyage across the Atlantic. But on September 6th, 1620, the Mayflower set out from Plymouth with what Bradford called a prosperous wind. Robert Cushman had not been the only Leidener to abandon the voyage. His friend William Ring had also opted to remain in England, as had Thomas Blossom. By the time the Mayflower left Plymouth, the group from Leiden had been reduced by more than a quarter. The original plan had been to relocate the entire congregation to the New World. Now there were just 50 or so of them, less than a sixth of their total number, and only about half of the Mayflower's 102 passengers. John Robertson had no way of knowing their numbers would be so dramatically depleted by the time they left England for the last time, but the Pilgrims' minister had anticipated many of the difficulties that lay ahead. His selfless yet strong-willed insistence on probity would be dearly missed by the Pilgrims in the months ahead. At least for now, they had the wisdom of his words. In a letter written on the eve of their departure from Holland, he urged his followers to do everything they could to avoid conflict with their new compatriots. Even if men such as Christopher Martin pushed them to the edge of their forbearance, they must quell any impulse to judge and condemn others. Robinson exhorted them to store up patience against that evil day without which we take offense at the Lord himself in his holy and just works. For the future welfare of the settlement, it was essential that all the colonists, Leideners and strangers alike, learn to live together as best they could. This non-judgmental attitude did not come naturally to the Leideners. As separatists, they considered themselves godly exceptions to the vast, unredeemed majority of humankind. A sense of exclusivity was fundamental to how they perceived themselves in the world. And yet there is evidence that Robinson's sense of his congregation as an autonomous enclave of righteousness had become considerably less rigid during his 12 years in Holland. By the time the Pilgrims departed for America, he had begun to allow members of his congregation to attend services outside their own church. Robinson's fierce quest for spiritual purity had been tempered by the realization that little was to be gained by arrogance and anger. For schism and division, Edward Winslow later wrote of Robinson, there was nothing in the world more hateful to him. This softening of what had once been an inflexible separatism was essential to the later success of Plymouth Plantation. In this regard, the loss of the Speedwell had been a good thing. Prior to their departure from Plymouth, the Leideners had naturally gravitated to their own vessel. But now, like it or not, they were all in the same boat. When he later wrote about the voyage of the Mayflower, Bradford devoted only a few paragraphs to describing a passage that lasted more than 2 months. The physical and psychological punishment endured by the passengers in the dark and dripping tween decks was compounded by the terrifying lack of information they possessed concerning their ultimate destination. All they knew for certain was that if they did somehow succeed in crossing this 3,000-mile stretch of ocean, no one, except perhaps for some hostile Indians, would be there to greet them. Soon after departing from Plymouth, the passengers began to suffer the effects of seasickness. As often happens at sea, the sailors took great delight in mocking the sufferings of their charges. There was one sailor in particular, a proud and very profane young man, Bradford remembered, who would always be contemning the poor people in their sickness and cursing them daily with grievous execrations. The sailor even had the audacity to say that he hoped to help to cast half of them overboard before they came to their journey's end. As it turned out, however, this strong and arrogant sailor was the first to die. "But it pleased God," Bradford wrote, "before they came half seas over, to smite this young man with a grievous disease, of which he died in a desperate manner, and so was himself the first that was thrown overboard." Bradford claimed, "It was an astonishment to all his fellows, for they noted it to be the just hand of God upon him." A succession of westerly gales required Master Jones to work his ship as best he could against the wind and waves. Several times during the passage, the conditions grew so severe that even though it meant he must lose many hard-won miles, Jones was forced to lie ahull, to furl the sails, and without a stitch of canvas set, secure the helm to leeward and surrender his 180-ton ship to the elements. In 1957, the crew members of the Mayflower II, a replica of the original vessel built in Brixton, England, became the first mariners of the modern era to experience what it was like to ride out a gale in a Jacobean-era ship. Over the course of the first few weeks of the passage, they had discovered that the Mayflower II's boxy hull shape took some getting used to. At times, the motion in the high-aft poop cabin became so violent that Captain Alan Villiers, one of the most experienced blue-water sailors in the world, feared that he might be flung out of his bunk. What this ship would do in survival conditions was a matter of deep concern to Villiers and his men. Toward the end of the voyage, a storm set in, forcing Villiers to do as Master Jones had done 337 years before. As the motion of the ship in the giant waves became intolerable, he decided he had no option but to lie ahull. The sails were furled, and everything on deck was tied down. Then, with considerable trepidation, Villiers ordered that the helm be secured to leeward. This was the crucial test, Villiers wrote. Would she lie that way, more or less quietly, with the windage of the high poop keeping her shoulder to the sea? Or would she just wallow hopelessly in the great troughs, threatening to roll her masts out? We didn't know. No one had tried the maneuver in a ship like that for maybe 2 centuries. As soon as the ship's bow swung into the wind, a remarkable change came over the Mayflower II. Even though she was under bare poles in a howling gale, her slab-like topsides functioned as a kind of wooden storm sail, magically steadying the ship's motion. Almost perfectly balanced, the Mayflower II sat like a contented duck amid the uproar of the storm. After being pounded unmercifully by the waves, the ship was finally at peace. I reflected that the Pilgrim Fathers, who tossed through many such a wild night in Atlantic storms, at least knew tranquility in great gales, Villiers wrote. In the fall of 1620, the Mayflower's ability to steady herself in a gale produced a most deceptive tranquility for a young indentured servant named John Howland. As the Mayflower lay ahull, Howland apparently grew restless down below. He saw no reason why he could not venture out of the fetid depths of the tween decks for just a moment. After more than a month as a passenger ship, the Mayflower was no longer a sweet ship, and Howland wanted some air, so he climbed a ladder to one of the hatches and stepped onto the deck. Howland was from the inland town of Fenstanton, Huntingdonshire, and he quickly discovered that the deck of a tempest-tossed ship was no place for a landsman. Even if the ship had found her own still point, the gale continued to rage with astonishing violence around her. The shriek of the wind through the rope rigging was terrifying, as were the sight of all those towering, spume-flecked waves. The Mayflower lurched suddenly to leeward, Howland staggered to the ship's rail, and tumbled into the sea. That should have been the end of him. But dangling over the side and trailing behind the ship was the topsail halyard, the rope used to raise and lower the upper sail. Howland was in his mid-20s and strong, and when his hand found the halyard, he gripped the rope with such feral desperation that even though he was pulled down more than 10 feet below the ocean surface, he never let go. Several sailors took up the halyard and hauled Howland back in, finally snagging him with a boat hook and dragging him up onto the deck. When Bradford wrote about this incident more than a decade later, John Howland was not only alive and well, but he and his wife, Elizabeth, were on their way to raising 10 children, who would in turn produce an astounding 88 grandchildren. A Puritan believed that everything happened for a reason. Whether it was the salvation of John Howland or the sudden death of the young sailor, it occurred because God had made it so. If something good happened to the saints, it was inevitably interpreted as a sign of divine sanction. But if something bad happened, it didn't necessarily mean that God disapproved. It might mean that he was testing them for a higher purpose. And as they all knew, the true test was yet to come. Unknown to Jones, and any other mariner of the day, was the presence of the Gulf Stream, a virtual river of warm water flowing up from the Caribbean along the North American coast, across the Atlantic, and past the British Isles. Bucking the Gulf Stream and westerly gales, the Mayflower had managed an average speed of just 2 miles an hour since leaving England back in September. Jones had a cross staff, a calibrated 3-foot-long stick equipped with a sliding vane that enabled him to calculate his latitude or north-south position within a few miles. But he had no reliable way of determining his longitude or east-west position. This meant that after all the bad weather they'd encountered, he had only the vaguest idea of how far he was from land. He knew the Mayflower was well north of her ultimate destination, the mouth of the Hudson River. But at this late stage in the voyage, with disease beginning to appear among the passengers and crew, he needed to find his way to the coast as quickly as possible. So he made a run for it, sailing west along a latitude that would lead him to the sandy peninsula known to most mariners of the time as Cape Cod. It was named Cape James in Captain John Smith's map of New England, but Jones didn't care what it was called. Reaching out to them like an upturned arm, the Cape was as good a target as any. The Mayflower pushed on until they were within smelling distance of the continent. Seagulls began to appear in the sky, and the color of the water changed from deep blue to pale green. And then, at daybreak, on Thursday, November 9th, 1620, after 65 days at sea, they saw land. Chapter 2. Dangerous Shoals and Roaring Breakers. It was a beautiful late fall morning, clear skies and light winds out of the northwest. There was a thin slice of moon overhead, gradually fading to nothingness as the sun rose behind them in the east. Up ahead to the west was what Jones believed to be the forearm of Cape Cod. Known to subsequent generations of mariners as the backside of the Cape, this almost 30-mile stretch of barrier beach runs from north to south and is edged by dramatic 100-foot-high cliffs of sand that must have been instantly recognizable to Jones's pilots if they had been in this region before. Stretching behind the cliffs were rolling, tree-covered hills. The Mayflower's passengers were, according to Bradford, not a little joyful. The clarity of the atmosphere on a crisp autumn day in New England shrinks the distances and accentuates the colors, and the pilgrims were much comforted by seeing so goodly a land and wooded to the brink of the sea. Just to make certain, Jones tacked the Mayflower and stood in for shore. After an hour or so, all agreed that this was indeed Cape Cod. Now they had a decision to make.